Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Tuesday, the 8th of March. This is a fascinating book. It's the story of two founders of very, very large cosmetic companies, Helena Rubinstein, uneducated daughter of a Jewish kerosene dealer in Krakow, who began by whipping up face creams out of lanolin and ended up running one of the largest private companies in this country, and Eugene Schuller, a workaholic chemist, son of a Parisian baker, who developed the world's first safe hair dye and established the L'Oreal brand. The book also weaves in discussion of the history of the times in which both of these people lived, and it's also a story of anti-Semitism and right-wing extremism in France, and it is a look at the colorful personalities and the drive that both of these individuals had, even though they didn't really cross paths, they didn't know each other. So at any rate, the book is called Ugly Beauty, Helena Rubinstein, L'Oreal, and the Blemished History of Looking Good. And Ruth Brandon is the author. Ruth is a cultural historian and a biographer. She is British, but she's joining us by phone today from France. She's written a number of detective stories and two literary novels and has written books. Oh, what a variety. The Automobile, Houdini, Sarah Bernhardt, the Anti-Nuclear Movement, and a number of other books on a wide range of topics. So beauty this hour and these personalities. She also includes chapters on the current beauty craze, Botox, plastic surgery. What's driving all of that? And it should be a fascinating conversation. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hi, Ruth. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Enjoying the sunshine.
Oh, don't even say that. We're waiting for the sunshine. We're waiting and waiting. What a fascinating book you have written here. I don't know where you got this idea or where you found, you know, all the information about these two people, but it is absolutely riveting.
Well, I started to get interested in cosmetics because I've one thing about all the books I write is they're about politics of one sort or another. I'm very interested in politics, my thoughts always seem to come round to that. And it struck me that cosmetics have always been extremely political. What you wear really isn't about politics. It's about fashion. It's, you know, your hemlines go up or down. You wear red today and blue tomorrow. But you wear something warm when it's cold and cool when it's warm, and that's more or less it. But cosmetics, it's really quite a different thing. Whether you paint your face at any one particular moment has always been quite an edgy question. And generally speaking, it seemed to me, whether it was encouraged in what's called respectable society seemed to follow the, more or less the relative freedom of women in any one culture. So I got very interested in this, and I came across a book by a woman called Monica Weitzfelder, who wrote about, it was called L'Oreal Stole My Home. And it was about L'Oreal and their Nazi connections, and their German during the war, and how that had that had taken possession of what had once been Monica Weitzfelder's large and expensive family home in Karlsruhe. And that got me very interested in Schuller. And then I started reading about L'Oreal's takeover of Helena Rubinstein, and that opened a can of worms, which was also about L'Oreal's Nazi past. So that got me very interested in the whole thing, and then I became interested in the whole connection between real fascism, if you like, and body fascism. And so one thing sort of led to another.
Oh, yeah, and there's so much there. Let's start with the story of Helena Rubinstein. When you look at her background, the oldest of eight, she had eight sisters. That's a lot, and probably her birth order made a difference here, because being first, she was the one who was to succeed and launch out in the world.
Yeah, typical firstborn.
Yeah. So she goes to, well, tell us the story of where she gets this face cream idea, how she gets it, and how she winds up in Australia, where she first becomes successful.
Well, she started out on her career by leaving home. I think she must have looked at her mother's life with, you know, endless children, endless babies, and thought, that really is not what I want to do. So she turned down the men her father found for her to marry, left home to his fury, went to stay briefly with an aunt in Vienna, and then left for Australia, where she had a couple of uncles, and who were living in a provincial town near Melbourne. And she simply hated it there. But she decided she had to do something else. And she was looking around for ideas what to do. And according to her memoirs, which are completely unreliable and full of total invention, she was constantly asked by her fellow Australians in this town where she was living, who was called Coleraine, what was the secret of her beautiful complexion? And she obviously did have a very good complexion. If you look at all the photographs of her, I mean, it was really lovely. And she told them that it was to do with her family face cream that was what they'd always used at home. She'd brought some of it with her to use there, and they all wanted some of it. So she sold them what she had and sent off for more. This is all her story, and that was the beginning of her business. In fact, that would have been completely impossible. But I think probably what happened was that she was asked about the secret of her complexion, and it started her thinking that face cream might be the way to a business.
Right. And what was the secret of her beautiful complexion?
I think partly it's birth, myself. I mean,
right.
I think, frankly, you either have a good skin or you don't. I mean, you can help it. And if you're in a place like Australia, which is hot and very windy and very dry, obviously moisturizing it will help. But I think she just had a very good skin. But she was obviously very, very good at persuading people. She was a really talented trader. And Australia at that time, she eventually just opened her business in Melbourne in 1901, I think it was, and her story was that she got face cream sent over from Poland, but in fact, she made them up herself. Australia's full of sheep, and sheep make lanolin, and lanolin is a very good moisturizing agent. And she has recipes which show how she did it. It was an emulsion of lanolin with various other things and perfume, and then with added perfume. And she started to pack this up and sell it, and she obviously had a very good manner. And the thing about Melbourne at that time was that it had, even that early in the 20th century, it had a very large population of working women who earn money that they could then spend as they want. And by 1905, she was extremely rich. Hello, you with me?
Yes, we are. We're getting a little bit of a breakup, but I hear you. Yes.
Yeah. And so that was the story of the beginning of her business. And by 1907, she was a millionaire effectively, and was on her way back to Europe to get more tips on how to improve her business.
Remarkable. So working women, having women who are in the workforce and able to spend their money, is a key to her success.
Absolutely, because what happened in the 19th century was that had been one of the periods when women were not. When respectable women did not paint their faces, and that was echoed, or that the corollary of that was their social position, which was extremely secondary. Certainly in Britain at that time, wives were literally wholly owned chattels of their husband. Anything that they owned before they married became part of their, but became their husband's property the instant they got married. And I mean the story was, the official line was that if you painted your face, that was whorish, and no respectable wife would want to do that, because why would you do it except in order to attract men? My view is, and this is borne out by some of the historical cases, you can see where women, there was one beauty trader who opened up in the 1860s who was prosecuted, and it's quite clear from her case that people found, she was tremendously successful, incidentally, and people found this success very worrying, and it seems to me fairly clear that the reason they found it worrying is because it's obvious, two things were obvious. One is that the women who went to her and spent their money, spent lots of money on beauty products, did it, although they knew their husbands didn't want them to, so it was open defiance of men.
Ah.
And the other thing was, why did they do it? They did it because it really made them feel better,
mm-hmm.
wearing this stuff and having this stuff. And it seems to me fairly clear that beauty, the whole beauty business, is about selling self-confidence. What women want, they want to look their best. Why do you want to look your best? It's because it makes you feel that you can face the world. And if you put on lipstick, you think you look better. And it makes you feel the world, face the world better. If you're having a bad hair day, what that implies is that you're looking terrible and nothing will go right.
Absolutely. She also was this marvelous marketer. She knew the power of an interview and getting her ideas splashed all over. And this idea, which is so prevalent in makeup these days, that if you pay a lot of money for something, it's going to work even better. So if things weren't selling very well, one product line, she'd make it more expensive so people would think that it's definitely going to work because it costs so much?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what happened was, again, it's all about psychology. If you spend a lot of money on some product, it makes you feel that even if you're not rich, you're doing something or you've got something that is the same as rich women do and have.
Mm-hmm.
So, it doesn't matter what your own financial situation is. In this, at least, you've got luxury, and it makes you feel good.
Let's move into the story, because his story is equally as fascinating and extremely troubling, and that's the story of Eugene Schuller, workaholic chemist with anti-Semitic and right-wing associations and Nazi sympathies in France. And we even have an email that's come in who said they'll never buy a L'Oreal product because of his past. I don't think many people know about this past, but ooh-wee, what an association.
Yes, it's very, it's kind of, it isn't that thing. If you look at his background, again, he was a self-made man. He made it big. It was complete chance that he happened to hit on cosmetics. In fact, he did it. L'Oreal, the first L'Oreal product was a harmless hair dye. If you look at the American beauty literature of the 1930s, there was a consumer research publication called Skin Deep, which did an investigation into beauty, whether beauty products were or were not dangerous, and they found that a lot of hair dyes really were dangerous. They were extremely allergenic. If you used one, it was perfectly likely that you'd get a rash. But even so, women weren't using them. But what Schuller did, he invented the world's first artificial harmless hair dye, and he soon made a great deal of money out of it. I mean, beauty products at the beginning of the 20th century were an unexplored market because they'd been discouraged because respectable women didn't use beauty products. So here was sort of half the human race waiting for something. And if you were first in the field, as Rubinstein and then Eugene Schuller were, you made a lot of money very fast. So he did this. And by the 1930s, he was a multimillionaire. And he began to be interested, and a lot of businessmen were interested at that time, most famously Henry Ford, in running their businesses as a sort of small social, almost social state,
mm-hmm.
social welfare state.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the thinking was, here I am running this huge business. I mean, Ford, obviously, absolutely enormous, but Schuller, very large. And their interests extended outside just making money. They decided they would help their workers to live better lives. And what this led to in the case of Ford and also Schuller and a lot of other businessmen who did the same sort of thing at that time, it led to an extremely dictator-like view of the world, because they felt they knew how the world should be run. Therefore, they should be running not just businesses, but the world, and that politics could do with their expertise. Henry Ford became a devotee of Hitler. I mean, he famously funded Hitler and was decorated by Hitler. Schuller, I think France during the 1930s, there was almost a civil war between the communists and the fascists there, and as almost everywhere in Europe was deeply divided between the right and the left. Schuller, having started out as an idealistic young man before the First World War, before the Second World War, having introduced these social schemes for his workers, became more and more obsessed with economics. I think he saw, he also at the same time saw Germany under Hitler as going ahead in a way that France wasn't. He wished that France could do that. So that when Hitler did invade France in 1940, I think Schuller saw this as an opportunity, if he could join the French fascist government, to put his economic ideas into practice. So he got involved with the Nazis.
And did he profit from the war?
Sorry?
Did his business profit from the war, or did it go dry because of the war?
He made a lot of money during the war. People did. I mean, there's no doubt that if you were on the right side, if you collaborated with the Germans, you made a lot of money. And if you didn't, things could be very difficult for you. He wasn't alone in this. Almost all French industrialists had to collaborate with the Germans in a way if they wanted to stay in business. I mean, and if you think about it, if you were French in 1940, the army had collapsed. The Germans were there. It seemed inconceivable that Germany wasn't going to win the war. I mean, what do you do? Almost everybody sort of looked around, took a deep breath, and thought, how am I going to get into the future? What not many of them did, and what Schuller did, was actively collaborate, actively go into government with the Germans.
And he was tried after the war for industrial collaboration?
For industrial and for civil collaboration. And in fact, he got off both times. He got off by pulling strings. I mean, if he didn't collaborate, who did? But and then after a few years, it quieted down because people began to realize, like denazification in Germany, that if they just went on, France would never move forward. There was a great desire in France at that time to close the chapter and move on, so that people preferred to forget what had happened. And another reason they preferred to forget what had happened was because so many people who then continued in positions of power or became very powerful had been deeply involved with the Germans during the war.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email that's come in. I'm not sure who she referring to as the mother. To this day, the mother, referring to L'Oreal, is still anti-Semitic. She and her daughter are estranged because the daughter is married to a Jewish man. I can't even look at a L'Oreal product, let alone buy one.
There's a sort of very widely publicized case going on, which sort of hit the headlines during the second half of last year, in which Schuller's daughter, Liliane Bettencourt, who inherited the whole thing from him, she inherited his money, but not the business. Her husband got to run the business. She didn't, which we can come back to if you like, because this is all part of Schuller's dogma. Her daughter... She is in her late 80s, and she's isn't anymore quite in command of herself in the way that she was. I mean, I don't know if she has Alzheimer's, but she's certainly losing it slightly. And she fell into the clutches of a playboy who took one way or another, got her to make over €1 billion, if you can imagine that.
Ooh.
But she has many billions of euros. And the case was very complicated, and the daughter, who is married to a Jew, took her mother to court to try and get her declared incompetent.
Wow.
That's what that's about.
Yeah. We're going to take phone calls for Ruth, and we'll do so in just a moment. Ruth Brandon is our guest. Her book is Ugly Beauty, which is the story of Helena Rubinstein and also the story of Schuller. And it is a book about all kinds of things, about beauty and products and markup on products and how they're formulated, and both of these individuals' very, very interesting lives and politics, because it weaves in Nazi sympathies on the part of Eugene Schuller, the chemist who started the L'Oreal brand. And the story continues, as you just heard, into today. She also has some very interesting things to say about modern techniques for beauty and the push for plastic surgery and Botox and all of that. But both of these stories of both of these individuals are just really riveting, and she's a heck of a writer, too. So we'll go to your phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You may want to mark this on your calendar. Joyce Carol Oates will be joining us Thursday during this hour. 3 years ago, she lost her husband of more than 47 years. And her latest book is on the pain and the madness that enveloped her during the year that followed. So Joyce Carol Oates is with us on Thursday at 10 o'clock. We continue our conversation with Ruth Brandon. Her book is Ugly Beauty, Helena Rubinstein, L'Oreal, and the Blemished History of Looking Good. Hugh from Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. The reason I called, in advertising this program, you said that Helena Rubinstein was the first woman, or the millionaires. But I should mention that there was an American, Madam C.J. Walker, who whose line was also cosmetics. She had people selling her products door-to-door. She was born but 2 years after the big war. Her parents were slaves. But by 1905, she was established something for hair straightening. She was politically incorrect by today's standards, hair straightening for basically for black women's hair. And I think she also had skin lighteners and so forth. If I'm not by 1919, she is the wealthiest self-made woman in America, and a millionaireess. If I'm not mistaken, some of her products were used by Josephine Baker, you know, when Baker was in Paris, and I don't know if there'd be any influence on French cosmetics through that connection. On one more thing, though, on a different topic. I don't know if you realize it, but the men's deodorant and so forth in America, Axe, if I'm not mistaken, when it was introduced, when it was first introduced on television and so forth in advertising, it was called Axis, A-X-I-S, and the models for it might well have been Aryan. They looked very Aryan, shall we say.
Ruth.
Well, I did know about Madam C.J. Walker. In fact, I talk about her, and it's not at all a coincidence that these two very successful women made their fortunes in beauty products because, of course, this was a field that, for obvious reasons, men hadn't taken over yet because they dismissed it for so long that they hadn't realized what money there was to be made in it. In fact, I mean, if you're going to sort of have a race, Helena Rubinstein made her million before Madam C.J. Walker. But, I mean, I agree. They're both very remarkable women. What more can I say?
You write a little bit about skin whitening, and let's talk about
sure,
that
yes.
a wee bit. Was she interested in that? Did her products, well, they were bleaching products to get rid of aging spots and things like that?
No, she was strictly in hair straightening, but of course.
No, I mean Helena.
Helena Rubinstein. No.
No.
No. She wasn't really in bleaching products. She was kind of before that all became a very big thing. I mean, Madame C.J. Walker, of course, specialized in products for black women, but she was a black woman herself. That's become more contentious now because, of course, when, for example, we all want to look like the idol of the moment, if you like the face of the moment, but the face of the moment is increasingly undifferentiated, if you like. So that, for example, when Beyoncé, there was a very big storm. You probably remember when Beyoncé became the face of L'Oreal, the face that they used on the posters was a great deal lighter than actual Beyoncé.
Mm-hmm.
They denied it, but it's the trend is always to try and look like whichever group happens to be the powerful group at the time, and that you know, black women have historically, or black people have historically, tried to bleach their skin. It's a very unfortunate thing, but that's why.
Mm-hmm. How long has and how does play? How does her whole line of products and his whole line of products, if at all, play into this desire to live forever, to deny the fact that we're going to die?
Well, obviously. What beauty products do? One of the things, the main market for beauty products is middle-aged women. I mean, there are also men now, of course, but mm-hmm. assuming that the main market for beauty products is generally women, it's mostly middle-aged women. And the reason that middle-aged women start to use beauty products is obviously because they hope that it'll make them look younger for longer. And I mean, the woman I referred to, who got put on trial in 1868, her motto was "beautiful forever," and that's really what we all want, isn't it? To be beautiful forever. When we're young, we are beautiful, and when we're middle-aged and elderly, we hope that using this stuff will make us be beautiful forever. What the difference with what's happening now is that. Instead of just putting stuff onto our faces, we can either put stuff into them,
right,
or we can cut ourselves. You know, we can carve ourselves into new shapes.
I know. It makes me cringe.
So that instead of having to effectively make the best of what we've got, it's more and more accepted these days that you don't have to make the best of what you've got. You can change what you've got in a very substantial way, and. You can make wrinkles disappear, and you can, you know, keep on lifting your face. Whether that makes you look younger is another matter, but it makes you perhaps feel younger. Now, why people do this is a very good question. Obviously, because they don't want to look older. But it's partly to do. I mean, why are we afraid of looking older? Because, of course, every new wrinkle is sort of one step nearer the grave, I guess. Whether people feel that ironing out the wrinkles will actually make them live longer or just make them live better, I don't know.
I don't either. Was she interested? She was, I know, in plastic surgery. And actually, plastic surgery in some form has been around for thousands of years, you write
Absolutely,
in the book.
Yeah. But it hasn't been effective until really recently. What drove it forward was World War One and World War Two. After World War One, those plastic surgeons had become much more skillful, and they began to ask themselves whether private practice might be a viable way to make a living. And they very very soon realized that it certainly would. And then in World War Two, they became more skillful yet, and. It's really, though, only in the last since the turn of the century, really, the turn of the millennium, over the last decade or so, that it's become so completely accepted that you can just, you know, have a new boob job as easily as a new bathing costume. It's a very weird world, isn't it?
It is a weird world.
These television programs, you know. It's become a sort of theatrical show.
Right. And we all think about it. You know, I don't know too many of my friends, and myself included, who haven't sort of pulled up your neck to see how you'd look if you pulled your neck back a little bit so that it was tighter.
How do you find yourself? I mean...
It looks better, but I would never do it. Ooh, the thought of going under the knife for something like that.
Well, it's very strange. it's quite a serious operation. I mean, I do it, and I look at myself, and I think, well, it doesn't make me look like I looked 20 years ago. It makes me look different. I mean, it makes me look unlined, but not young.
Yeah.
And it's a very strange face. It always seems to me it's kind of new. you meet somebody and you think, wow, I mean, she looks strange. Now, what is this? And then you suddenly realise, you know, this person has had a facelift or is using, and they aren't the age they look, but they're not young either. It's very strange, I find.
And that's a weird way to meet somebody, to know there's something and think, oh, you had work done. What kind of work did you have done? Isn't that a strange way to encounter somebody?
Well, it is strange, but you do, don't you?
Right. Yeah, you definitely do. Was she interested or was he interested in this whole field, which is still growing right now, in cosmetics for men? Why did men start using things?
Oh, Helena Rubinstein was intensely interested in cosmetics for men because that was a potential doubling of her customer base. But it didn't take off. She tried it before the war, but it didn't take off. And then during the war, she got to supply the American Army with kits for soldiers in the desert, moisteners and aftershave and all sorts of things. They were in the PX. And these little sort of makeup kits, they all had Helena Rubinstein on the lid. And then after the war, so that got men kind of used to using these things. And after the war, more and more of them got to use these products. But now, men are becoming extremely interested in this whole plastic surgery thing, not only because more men, as people get fatter, are growing boobs and they want to get rid of them, but also because as the job market dries up, people are more and more terrified of looking old because they feel that this will put them at a disadvantage because there's always a younger generation coming on.
What a weird world.
So you get stories
world.
Of bankers, you know, who two years ago they were all sacked when all the banks went bust. They all used, apparently a great many of them used their redundancy money to buy face jobs.
Oh, my gosh, you're kidding me. That makes it even worse. I was mad enough. Oh, no.
Not
the
really.
Nerve.
There were headlines in the newspapers about it.
Oh.
I mean, you know, makes you have even less sympathy with bankers than you had before.
Yeah, exactly. Here's our phone number. Join the conversation if you'd like. Hugh, thanks for your call. We're speaking with the author of Ugly Beauty, Helena Rubinstein, L'Oreal, and the Blemished History of Looking Good. Ruth Brandon is our guest. Not only is it very, very interesting studies, just human studies of these two people, the founders of the Helena Rubinstein product and the founder of L'Oreal, but it also looks at the politics of their times. It looks at their families and it looks at their traveling really all over the world and how they marketed products and how expensive those products are and why it is that we use any of these products. Why do we paint our faces and dye our hair and how long have we been doing that and how does it make us feel? It's all in the book. Because Ruth is a wonderful writer. She's a cultural historian and biography who's written a number of books about all kinds of different subjects, and she makes the stories fascinating. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email address, if you would like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. If you dye your hair or you paint your face or you've undergone the knife for some kind of procedure to make you look better, what has it done for you? Why do we do all of this? And why do we spend incredible amounts of money? And what do you think of these stories of these two people? They're quite compelling. So if you want to call, that's fine. If not, we'll just talk. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ruth Brandon, our guest, and our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. Ruth, I know that Helena Rubinstein really would love to have been a doctor, and you frequently see her in her lab coat. Did both of these people, Helena and Eugene, have to know a lot about chemistry? Did they take courses in science so they could do what they did?
Schiller knew a great deal about chemistry. He was a very gifted chemist, and he got an education, and then took a course. He took courses in Paris, and there's no doubt that he could have become a research chemist if he'd have wanted to. An academic research chemist, but he thought academic life was rather dull, and that academics didn't work hard enough, and he decided to go into industry. But his chemical expertise was the basis of his fortune. Helen Rubinstein was completely different. She had no education at all, and she was completely self-taught. She learned how to make up beauty creams, and she knew from the very beginning that selling them was a matter of persuading. It wasn't about what was really in them. It was about persuading people what they might do, that the cream would do what the people wanted it to do. Her motto for advertising was fear copy with a bit of blah blah. So first of all, she made you frightened about how you weren't looking so good and you wouldn't look as good. And then she added the bit of blah blah, and that was all about how her creams came from sort of rare herbs in the Carpathian Mountains and blah blah like that. But just as today, it was important. The beauty business was founded on the assumption that all its claims were scientifically founded, were scientifically provable, and. Helena Rubinstein liked to say that she'd been to medical school in Poland. In fact, that was complete fabrication. She hadn't been to anywhere near a university. There was simply no question of it, and she left when she was 18 anyway. When she'd got enough money together, she came back to Europe, and she spent 3 months whizzing round European dermatologists and learning what she could, and by the end, she did pick up some knowledge, and she got to know people who did know about dermatology, and by the end of it, I think she probably did know a great deal about people's skins, but it was all what she'd picked up. I mean, none of it was from education.
Remarkable. Let's go to some phone calls. Laura from New Berlin. Hi, Laura.
Kathleen and guests, I couldn't help but think of a comment that I heard a couple of weeks ago on the BBC, that being a clip with the longtime reporter from the Mideast, a British fellow for the Independent, Robert Fisk, who mentioned that he had a friend or colleague that traveled to personally see Gaddafi, and astonishingly, Gaddafi's primary concern seemed to be on getting a facelift.
Oh, my gosh.
And I wondered if the guest had heard, and it sure seems to fit in with the whole megalomania complex swirling about him.
Mm.
I hadn't heard that, actually. But, it seems fairly typical. What can I say?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Laura. We'll check that story out. It does make sense that somebody
Absolutely.
Like that would certainly think of getting one. Tom in Stoddard. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I would like to ask the guest if she has put anything in the book about the bad chemicals that are so generally used in the makeup industry. I'm thinking particularly of phthalates and other poisonous products that have been used for many years, but the new industries is our new technology is putting in some very dangerous things that haven't been historically used. And the book Death by Rubber Duck, I can't remember the author, points out a lot of these.
No, I don't talk about that, though I do talk about books that do talk about it. In particular, there was a huge bestseller in the 1930s, which was all about that, all about the stuff that was being used then, and the effect of that was that a lot of beauty products, that their recipes were very, very quickly and suddenly altered. So this wouldn't happen. I mean, people were afraid that it would kill the entire beauty business, but of course it didn't, because one of the things that you realize when you look into all this stuff
is that however dangerous it is, and whatever you're risking, people will still put the stuff onto and into their faces and have these operations. I mean, there was a horrendous story just recently about some young woman who went and had some kind of breast job and died. Sorry?
Yes, terrible.
Yeah, I forget exactly where. But sorry, yes, my husband, who's sitting the other side of the room, correct. It was a buttock job, a buttock lift.
Oh,
you can believe this. And people will just do it. I mean, the industry. I think obviously people don't want their patients to die, and I think the industry.
No, of course not.
And also, of course, people are terrified of being sued. But equally, obviously, there are a lot of pirates around, and you get a lot of medical tourism these days. You know, people go to Brazil or Poland and sort of in search of cheap plastic surgery. And you get what you pay for, I guess.
Mm. Thanks, Tom, for the call. Mary Beth in Waterford. Hi, Mary Beth.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't know that I actually have anything too much to offer, but you reminded me of something that has happened over my past. When I was 30, on my 30th birthday, I had thought to give myself breast implants, but instead I ended up buying new furniture with that money instead. And over the course of 2 decades, and a few teenage boys, of course, the furniture was demolished. And I was just heartsick that I never had gotten, you know, the boob job, because, of course, I'd have the boobs. but then I quit smoking. Here's the upshot of it. I quit smoking a few years ago and put on about 20 pounds, and my breasts just grew naturally. They're lovely, naturally so.
Oh, my gosh.
I talked to a plastic surgeon, and he said that in his experience, boob jobs, whether it's reductions or enhancements, usually do make the person feel better. So,
and you had thought, didn't you, did I read this right in your book, didn't you think about a reduction at some point in your life?
I had never thought about it, but I just wanted to sort of see. I just wanted to, that people were advertising on public transport system, you know, come and get a boob job. It, you know, so it was sort of like, really like putting on a new bra, as easy as that. And so I went along. They said, you know, come along for a free consultation. So I went along for a free consultation. And I told them that I wasn't going to have any of their whatever they were offering. But I've got large boobs, and I've always hated them. And I always, it never crossed my mind to do anything about it. And I certainly wouldn't bother to do anything now. But it was incredibly persuasive. I mean, the notion that you can get rid of something you hate and get and end up looking better for, you know, a few thousand bucks, it's very tempting.
Yeah. Why have you hated them?
Well, I just do. I suppose they get in the way, you know, every time you want to run, every time you want, there they are bouncing about. That means, you know, when I was young, I couldn't wear strapless dresses. I couldn't go without a bra. It was boring.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Nobody's happy with what they've got.
I know, isn't it true? When you think of all the people around who would pay to have your breasts, probably, you know, it's just, what
just
a world.
I to my friend, go on, have my extra.
Thanks, Mary Beth, for your call. We go to Pat next in Milwaukee. Hi, Pat.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is such a fun conversation. I'm a cosmetologist, and I think about this stuff a lot.
I'm sure.
Like I think about getting plastic surgery to take off my, you know, my two fat earlobes, you know, to make my ears look like when I was younger. You know, earrings kind of pull your earlobes down.
I never thought about that in my life. I'm getting old too. I never thought about that. Really?
Like, yeah, I like wearing short hair, and I thought about that. And, of course, when I found out how much it was, I was like, okay, I'll keep my fat earlobes.
How much is it, Pat?
Pardon me?
How much is it to have your earlobes?
At the time I called, I think it was $700 per ear.
Ooh-wee.
I know. These guys make money. No wonder they advertise a lot. But I do believe in balance, and I do believe in feeling good. And the one thing that I will say for myself, and I even advise other people, if you go gray or, you know, very gray, and you feel good and you're out exercising and you're being the same old you and you're feeling good about yourself, go for it. It's way healthier. You know, not that, well, I don't even know how pathetic getting your hair colored is, but I can tell you that I would still do it rather than be gray because I look very pasty and pallid when I'm gray. And a lot of people say, you know, I let it go gray, but I just feel so old, and then I feel tired, and then it affects my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as just going, not having balance there and controlling your urges, yeah, wouldn't we all like to be, you know, a Barbie doll? Not happening. So I just believe in balance and the just the little bitty things that make us feel well-groomed or energetic, or even if we feel younger, I think it's good.
Ruth, what do you think? Are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, what do you think of her comments?
Well, I think that's right. I thought you were signing me off.
Oh, no, no,
yeah,
no.
It's exactly what I was saying. What the beauty business is about is psychology. It's about selling confidence or really, it's about making you feel better. And in order to make you feel better, it first of all has to make you feel not so good.
Uh-huh.
But quite often you don't feel so good anyway, in which case it's not about what you really look like, it's what you think you look like.
Right.
And the whole thing is about psychology.
Isn't it strange, though, that you're worried about the size of your breasts? She's worried about her earlobes.
Exactly.
I had no idea that they grew longer. I mean, who would notice that on a human being? But she notices
it. She would notice. This is the point. She would notice. And it isn't. This is why the Victorians got so worried. It isn't about what anybody else thinks. It's entirely about what you think. It's entirely about your view of what you are presenting to the world.
Right. Did Helena Rubinstein worry about getting old? She lived to be a very old woman.
She did. She lived to be 92, and she stayed in charge of her business until the very last moment. It was so interesting. She had about 25, 27 portraits painted of herself, so no one could say that she wasn't vain. And the last one was done when she was 88, and it was done by a British portrait painter called Graham Sutherland. And he did some sketches, and then she came along the next day, and she'd had a fall, and she'd got a couple of black eyes, and she'd tried to sort of do her makeup to make it look as though it wasn't black eyes, but it was. It was something that she meant to do. And he was so impressed by this. He said he'd never realized what makeup could do, so he painted her with this extraordinary, this ancient woman wearing this red brocade dress by Balenciaga with this amazing eye makeup on and her sort of her black hair pulled back in a chignon. And She said she was, first of all, when she saw the portrait, she was completely appalled by it. She said, God, it never crossed my mind that I looked like that. We all, you know, we see the face in the mirror. We see it every day. And you although you know, you realize when you see a photo of yourself from 20, 30 years ago that you are not the person you once
right.
were. You look very different. The change doesn't really register from moment to, you know, from day to day. And so you think, you know, you're just the same old person you ever were. So I guess, you know, it must have been a real shock to see this extraordinary picture of this ancient painted person. But then afterwards, she got to really like it, and she declared it was a masterpiece.
And so it was, if she declared it.
It's a terrific picture.
the other fascinating, well, both characters are fascinating, but it was interesting that she brought most of her sisters and a lot of her cousins into the business. Did they profit from it as well as she did, or close to that?
No, absolutely. They all became pretty rich, and she left. She left the business to the family. Really, she didn't make any arrangements. But what she did think was that women should work. She thought work is the best beauty treatment. Mm. She said this at the end of her life. Mm-hmm. And when Ernestine Carter, a famous beauty editor, congratulated her on bringing all her sisters over and bringing them into the business, her sisters and their cousins, Helen Rubinstein looked at her and said, "Better they work."
It's good for all of us, I think. Well, you're a heck of a writer, and I've thoroughly enjoyed this. I'm imagining you in the countryside in France, and I'm a wee bit envious, but sounds lovely. Thank you, Ruth, so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Ruth Brandon, the book is Ugly Beauty, Helena Rubinstein, L'Oreal, and the Blemished History of Looking Good. It's such a great read. It makes me want to go to some of her other books and very, very different subjects that she has written about. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production. And thanks for all of your calls. I'm Kathleen Dunn, broadcasting from downtown Milwaukee. Tomorrow during our 9 o'clock hour, John Gerda will be joining us. He is a Milwaukee historian and wrote a very provocative piece in Sunday's Journal Sentinel, if you want to read it before we chat tomorrow morning.